Hi, welcome to Whiskey Cast, the Cask Strength podcast featuring news and interviews from the world of whiskey. I'm Mark Gillespie. This is episode number 71 for December 16th, 2006. Coming up in a few minutes.
What you must look at the whiskey and say to it immediately, is it heavy or is it light? Is it dry or is it sweet? And take it from there. So think of it as heavy as your grandfather, as light as your mother, as sweet as the chocolate bar that you've got there, or is it dry as the stones and the dust that are on the floor?
That's Richard Patterson, master blender at White & Mackay, and one of the industry's leading whiskey blenders. He'll share his philosophy on blends versus single malts with us. But first, let's look at the news. Earlier this fall, Stuart Thompson resigned as distillery manager at Ardbeg. Now, the Scotch Whiskey Review is reporting that Glenmorangie PLC has hired his replacement. Michael Heads is said to be leaving Isle of Jura to return to his native Isla to take over Ardbeg. As of now, there's no official word from Glenmorangie, but if it's true, it would be the first time that all of Isla's distilleries have been managed by native Illyachs. More on this in the next episode of Whiskey Cast. And by the way, the next issue of the Scotch Whiskey Review is at the printers now. The boys at Duncan Taylor & Company are busy today. Turns out they have two casks of Highland Park Single Malt that are both 40 years old today, and they're bottling both of them to celebrate. It's the second time Duncan Taylor has released a 1966 Highland Park, and the first bottle from that first release is now on the auction block, along with five other first bottles from previous Duncan Taylor releases. Duncan Taylor's Ewan Chand has been auctioning off the first bottles for charity.
We've exceeded expectations. It's been in the thousands of pounds. Some of the bottles are you know, achieving £300 for a single bottle. And I mean, that's an outrageous amount, but people are willing to pay it, and it's going to charity. So, or part's going to charity, not all of it. You've got to remember, I'm an Aberdonian.
All kidding aside, part of the proceeds from this latest auction will be donated to Oxfam for hunger relief efforts. All of the bottles are single casks, including a 1969 Kinclaith, a 1981 Brora, a 1975 Mostowy, a Bowmore from 1968, and what may be one of the few bottles of Strathclyde as a single grain from 1973. Details on bidding are available at the Duncan Taylor website. Duncan Taylor's Highland Parks are likely the oldest bottlings of Highland Park on the market, for now. Highland Park distillery manager Russell Anderson told me during Whiskey Fest in New York recently that plans are in the works to release a 40-year-old official bottling.
What do you have back in the warehouse that you're not telling us about?
That's a secret, Mark. That's why you don't know about it. Our oldest product at the moment is around about early 1960s. And in the next couple of years, you'll find a 40-year-old product hitting the market. And some of the 40-year-old casks and older in our warehouses are absolutely glorious. So, really, we've got a number of hidden gems tucked away, ready to spring out to the marketplace.
Right now, the Highland Park 30-year-old is the distillery's oldest official bottling. You may remember the story in the last episode about the Murray Brewing Company's single malt distillery in Pakistan. I asked for tasting notes from a Whiskey Cast listener, and within 24 hours I had an email from Professor Lex Krajveld of the University of Southampton in the UK. Lex is also one of the malt maniacs, and I've placed a link at WhiskeyCast.com to his tasting notes posted on the Celtic Malts website. Without getting into the details, let's just say he prefers the 8-year-old Murray to the 12-year-old, and the 8-nosed of slightly rancid butter. Thanks, Lex. One new whiskey event to add to the calendar this week. Malt Advocates John Hansel will host a single malt tasting at DBA in New York on Monday the 18th. After that, it's quiet until after the holidays. You'll find a complete calendar of events for 2007 on the WhiskeyCast website. It's www.whiskeycast.com. I like to think of the difference between blended scotch and single malts in musical terms. Consider the blend as a choir or maybe an orchestra, with musicians each contributing their own strengths to the end result. On the other hand, single malts are like a great soloist, perhaps a violinist or an operatic tenor, equally wonderful, and the choice of whiskey, just like the choice of music, depends on one's mood. Where does bourbon fit in? I will not extend that analogy to think of bourbon as a jug band compared to the symphony of scotch. But if we're thinking of scotch in classical terms, then perhaps bourbon is the jazz counterpart, just as musically complex, but with a spirit that clearly sets it apart. Where is this headed? Well, let's think of a master blender as a symphony conductor, one who takes many different instruments and pulls them all together. If that's the case, then Richard Patterson is clearly a maestro. He's been blending whiskeys for more than 3 decades at White & Mackay, and like more than a few giants of classical music, was something of a child prodigy.
Well, my father and my grandfather were whiskey blenders, so in fact, whiskey runs in my blood. So I started with my father when I was 8 years old at the Stockwell Bond, and he introduced it to me in a sort of rough way. He actually handed me a glass of whiskey in the Bond and said, "Well, what do you think of this, son?" And I said, "What do you mean, Dad?" He said, "Think about what you're smelling and let me know what you, you know, what you see in the whiskey." And of course I said, "I don't know what you're talking about, Dad." And that's when he hit me in the back of the head and said, "You're not thinking. What you must look at the whiskey and say to it immediately, is it heavy or is it light? Is it dry or is it sweet? And take it from there." So think of it as heavy as your grandfather, as light as your mother, as sweet as the chocolate bar that you've got there, or is it dry as the stones and the dust that are on the floor? So from there I was able to begin trying to describe what whiskies were all about, and I built it up from there. And so that's how I got into the industry. I really joined my first company when I was 17 years old, went to Glen Scotia, was there for 4.5 years with Glen Scotia Distillery, and then I joined White Mackay, and that was 37 years ago.
Did you really have any choice other than to become a blender?
I suppose what I did was that I got the job because of my father. And that was a disadvantage. And really what I had to do from there was to go out and study wines, study whiskies, and really get behind it. I was very lucky because I became very passionate about what I was doing. And there then came about an opportunity. The blender that was working for White Mackay left the company and I took over. So that was a very fortuitous time. It was a very lucky time. And I built up, you know, from there.
What did that first dram taste like? What did you nose out of it?
When I took it for the first time, I had not actually used any water. So immediately that whiskey hacked me, knocked me out. But the smell of the whiskey was very similar. It was something I'd grown up with. When my father used to come home late at night, I used to hear the noise of his car in the driveway and then the footsteps. And then suddenly I'd hear this beard, you know, the roughness because he hadn't shaved, obviously, you know, for 24 hours. And then that smell of whiskey. So it sort of put me off. But when I actually drank it, it reminded me immediately of my father's breath. I actually hadn't taken it properly. I should have taken it with a lot of water and built up from there. And it's until much later on that I use water. That's why when I'm doing presentations today, I always say to my fellow consumers, make sure you add it a little water, take it down to 38% alcohol, and then hold it in the mouth. Keep it in the mouth, and then let it come up.
What is the secret to making a good blend?
So the secret of making good blend, first of all, you must create a character of the blend. No matter what you do, you must create that character. But the most important thing, without question, is maintaining the consistency. If you do a blend and you can't maintain the consistency, you're not going to achieve your objective. You're not going to get the clients coming back again day after day. So the continuity style, and you do it that way by preparing it, allocating good whiskies, the reliable whiskies, but in the very best of woods. Wood is, without question, what it's all about. If you've got good wood, you've got great whiskey.
How long did it take you to get to that point?
Literally, I would say to you that although I've been a blender for, say, 35 years, I'm actually still learning. I mean, every day, every year that goes by, there's always something new happening. And we're experimenting all the time. I'm using different woods, different styles, different ages, older, younger. using maybe less in a blend, maybe more in a blend. So there's always experiments going on. But when you become a blender, there's something that's inherent in your heart. And when you actually see something that is right, you instinctively know you have that warm feeling when you actually sample that whiskey. Every whiskey that I look at today in the sample room, I'm still excited by what it's going to tell me. And in its own way, it will tell you. You know, as soon as you nose it, hello, how are you? And then put it in your mouth and hold it, it then comes to fruition. But it's still a mystery until you nose it and take it from there.
What do you learn from these mysteries? What do you learn over time that makes you a better blender? What makes you a better blender?
I think it makes you a better blender as long as you are prepared to experiment and to take risks. What I mean by that, taking risks, a calculated risk that the wood that you want it to develop in is going to give you such and such a criteria. If it doesn't happen, don't worry. You need to think about it. I've produced many different styles over the years, and I've found, wait a minute, that's not right, and it's been very disheartening. And then what I've done is I've left that whiskey for maybe a year, 2 years, 3 years, and then suddenly it becomes something unexpectedly beautiful that I never thought it would happen. All I was doing was I was pushing the whiskey. It wasn't ready to perform. It had to be given time, and, you know, that's what comes about. If you give whiskey its time, it will perform, but don't be in a hurry.
We have this whole controversy over blends versus single malts. What's your preference and why?
Actually, it's a very, very good question. Well, you've got to remember that blended whiskey still accounts for about 91% of the market. 9% is for single malts, and there's always this controversy. As far as I'm concerned, they both have their attributes. Personally speaking, I love blended whiskies because I'm able to use all these wonderful single malts together, blend them, harmonize, and enhance each other, and therefore they're very gentle and they're very warm. Whereas single malts have got to be looked at in a sort of different light, an individual person. You've no longer got a million different people, many different people in front of you. You've got one single character. So therefore, you've got to be prepared to accept that individual character. If you make friends with somebody, you might not get on with them, but I'm sure they've got an attribute you've got to remember and to learn and to go with. So you take your time, and it's the same with taking your time with a single malt. Give it time, but don't expect, you know, wonders every time you see a different malt.
Now, you actually do double duty. In addition to making the White and Mackay blends, you also blend the Dalmore. What goes into blending a single malt to make sure that it's consistent from batch to batch?
Batch to batch is a very good question because you're using the same degrees as well. When I'm producing a blended whiskey, I will use as many as 35 to 40 different component parts. When I'm using a single malt, I'm not using different component parts, but what I am using is maybe 160 casks. It's 160 casks taken from the top, the middle, and the bottom of the stoves. They're brought together, and by using all these different single casks, I get the continuity that I'm looking for. But it's the casks at the end of the day. If you do not have good casks for your single malt, you will go off into another dimension. And therefore, you must, in fact, mix the whiskies together. That's why when I say you mix some years with other years of single malts, people say, but that's no longer a single malt. It is a single malt. You can do as many different ages with that single malt as long as you don't add anything else. All the same, it will remain a single malt.
I want to go back to what you said just now about you take the top, the middle, and the bottom of the stills.
Yes.
That's something I've not heard before.
Yeah, you come with me, and I showed you whiskies from the top, middle, and the bottom of the stills. I remember years ago, it was at Tamatan Distillery, when I was very young at the time, and I went into the Tamatan Distillery, and I said to the manager then, who was John McDonald, I said, I've come to nose the whiskies. He said, have you got them lined up? And he said, no, I haven't got them lined up. You get off your backside, and you climb up into the stoves of the whiskies, excuse me, and you'll nose them from there. And by doing that, what I did find, they were all different whiskies. They were all the same Dalmores, but we were maturing them actually at Tamatan at that stage. And what we found was the whiskies at the bottom, as opposed to the whiskies at the top, were different. And the reason for them being different is it was damp at the bottom and it was very dry at the top. So although I'm actually losing whiskey by the strength of the whiskey at the bottom, the ones at the top retained their strength but evaporated more. So that's why you will see these kind of differences, but you'll only see them if you get and walk in these stoves. You can only see the differences when you line them up, but you've no idea what's contributed to that. And that's the reason why they'll be different.
What do you say to those people, for lack of a better word, so-called connoisseurs, who say single malts are the only way to go?
Well, they you know, get a life, because in actual fact, there is lots of variety. It's the same with the variety of whiskies. You've got great whiskies, you know, single malts, and you've got blended whiskies. You've got great bourbons. You've got small batch, and you've got bourbons, you know, blended, you know, from the various distilleries like Beam with Claremont and Boston Distillery. So, you know, what you must do is you must experiment. You can then come back and make your own mind up. But don't just settle. Variety is the spice of life.
Now, I know last year that you did the whiskey magazine Dial-A Malts, or the Speyside Malts, rather, and you went back and picked some older stuff out of your stockpiles.
Yes.
As opposed to a White & Mackay blend, when you're creating a one-off of whatever you can come up with, what are you thinking about that?
What I wanted to do with the Speyside malts that I blended together was charm elegance, but more importantly, I wanted to have backbone, because there was a lot of aged whiskies there, and I wanted to soften them down, and that's why we used the Tan Vullen and the Tomental from the Speyside Valley to give you that elegance and that refinement. When you think of these whiskies, they have to be reflected of the area, and really the Tan Vullens that were used, as well as the other great whiskies, Macallans and the Glenlivets, Glenfiddichs and Balvenies, they were very, very charming, elegant in their own mind. But it is that lovely sort of lasting notes that are creamy and warm, but has that finesse, and only the Speyside malts. Okay, there are other malts, but really that's where the heart of a great malt is, in Speyside, to have the finesse coming through.
Let me ask you the same question I ask every other master distiller and blender. A few years from now, when it comes down to that one last dram before the good Lord calls you home, and I see you shaking your head,
wow,
out of all the stuff you've worked with over the years, what's it going to be?
I suppose it really has to come down to the 62-year-old Dalmore, the most expensive whiskey in the world. You know, to pay $46,000 for one bottle is crazy. But in actual fact, I worked with that whiskey for some like 15 years, developing it, nurturing it, putting it into different casks, and trying to preserve that goodness. And when you think of it, 1868, 1878, 1926, and 1939, it is phenomenal to have a whiskey of that nature. So therefore, you know, it is oldest, it is the most expensive, but people say to me, is it really worth $46,000? It's worth every penny. Because once you put it in your mouth, hold it there, and then let it go down, and then let all these wonderful attributes come up, it really is something you've never seen before.
The Isla Malt Richard blended for Whiskey Magazine is expected to go on the auction block this spring. When it does, I'll let you know. That's all for this edition of Whiskey Cast. Whiskey Cast is a production of MG Media, copyright 2006, and comes to you from the charming, yet regrettably dry town of Haddonfield, New Jersey. I'm Mark Gillespie, reminding you that, especially at this time of the year, when you drink, please drink responsibly. Thanks for listening.